Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA, podcast. I'm your host, Elisa Minkin, and I'm a general pediatrician, and I'm really excited and honored to be here today with Dr. Jonathan Howard for the third time. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I always love speaking to you. I sure appreciate the opportunity.
It's always a pleasure, and it's always an honor. Dr. Howard is a neurologist and psychiatrist at NYU and Bellevue Hospital. He is the director of neurology at Bellevue and the coordinator of the neurology clerkship. He received his MD from the University of Southern California and completed his residency in neurology and psychiatry, as well as a fellowship in multiple sclerosis at NYU. He's also the author of a recent 2019 book, Cognitive Errors and Diagnostic Mistakes, A Case-Based Guide in Critical Thinking in Medicine. You were actually my very first podcast interview in around January. I think it was released in February, but we recorded it really more towards the end of January 2020, when COVID-19 really hadn't hit our shores. And we did not know what was going to hit us. We really didn't. And so we talked about risk-benefit decision-making with something we knew about, which is the flu. You know, at the time they were saying, oh, you know, people underestimate the flu. They're so worried about this COVID thing, but they're not concerned enough about flu. So somebody listened to this talk recently and said, and when I say this talk, I mean the one, that first one that we did, called How to Fool Yourself Less: Medical Decision-Making for Regular People, from February 2020, and said you could take out the word flu and use COVID vaccine instead, and it would work just as well. And I have to take a minute to say that the flu is different from COVID for a number of reasons. The flu mutates quickly into different strains. We talk about variants when it comes to COVID, because fortunately for us, it's not mutating to that degree that it actually becomes a different strain. So it's been difficult for flu. We have to try to guess the exact strain. A lot of times we get it wrong, and it hasn't been our most effective vaccine. But we are seeing in real life, the COVID vaccine is not as effective as preventing the disease altogether as we had hoped it would be. So there are some parallels once we explain that there is a difference. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the flu shot first, just because it is fall and it is time for the flu shot. And I want to put a plug out there for that flu shot. And please, if you haven't listened to that first talk, go back and listen to it. I feel like it aged well. So, Dr. Howard, I want to give you a chance to talk. Let's start with some things people say about the flu shot or about the COVID shot for reasons they don't take it. So one thing they say is, like we mentioned already, it's not perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we are both advocates about vaccines, for vaccines, and the most important thing that we can do in that role is be honest and tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And no vaccine is perfect. No medicine, no treatment that we give is perfectly effective and perfectly safe. And the analogy that we always use, I probably use it during the first talk, I forget, but it is like seatbelts, right? So mm-hmm. A seatbelt, if you're in a horrible car crash, is not guaranteed to save your life, number one. Number two, if you're in a terrible car crash, the seatbelt can give you a bad bruise. I've seen people who've had, you know, more pictures than in real life, but you know, terrible seatbelt injuries. But the seatbelt drastically increases your chances of survival, and the people who had those nasty seatbelt injuries would not have survived had they not been wearing their seatbelt. So vaccines are a lot like that. Not perfectly effective, not perfectly safe, but you're much better off with the vaccine generally than you are with the virus for most diseases.
Right. Another thing I see a lot is people kind of freezing. They're like, okay, well, I keep hearing all these things. And I think it's really hard now because there's been such a glut of information, misinformation, and disinformation, and people get frozen. It's understandable. But they say, okay, I'm going to just wait. I'm not going to do anything.
It's understandable. But waiting is making a decision. And the virus doesn't know if you are unvaccinated because you're adamantly opposed to the vaccine, or you just want to wait a little bit more. Waiting is risky, and it depends on the lifestyle you lead. If you are sealed up in your room and you don't see anyone else and you never leave, which probably describes no one, you might not need the vaccine. But if you're out in the world, seeing your family and strangers and, you know, riding in elevators with people, I mean, I think eventually the virus will find you. You know, you can dodge it for the next week or, next month, maybe even the next year. But I this virus isn't going away. I think eventually it's going to find most people, unfortunately.
Right. And that's why I call this talk Living with COVID, because I think we're at the point in the pandemic. We've already hidden, from the virus. We've gone into lockdown. We have a vaccine now, although we say it's not perfect. It's not going away. There are some countries, I believe, Australia was one of them, that really wanted to get to zero COVID. And I think recently they just admitted defeat. I think there's a couple countries like Taiwan, that's an island, that might still be trying for zero COVID.
New Zealand.
Right. But these aren't most of the world. Whether they're able to get there, I mean, Australia already, is giving up. The expectation should be that the choice is virus or vaccine, not vaccine or nothing. And I've had a lot of people say, I haven't gotten COVID yet, and they knock on wood, as if that, is going to prevent them from getting COVID. It's like you said, you could live locked up, but, to the degree that we did, the vast, vast majority of us don't want to anymore. And right. It's becoming more prevalent. It's rising with the Delta wave, and it's more infectious. So it's just not a reasonable strategy to just think you're going to get away without getting it.
Right. I mean, back to my sort of driving analogy, fortunately, I've been very lucky. I've never been in a car crash. But every time I ride in a car, I wear my seatbelt, because that could be the time that I'm going to get in a car accident. And you can't count on a string of luck, occurring, because really all it takes is one unfortunate encounter. And, I've seen many people, including my family members, who, the only thing that they did was, go to the grocery or something like that.
Right.
And, that they contracted COVID there. And, you can be careful, but are you sure that everyone you come in contact with is careful? If you have young children, they're not eligible to be vaccinated yet. So, again, if you live in a pod and you're all sealed up by yourself, fine. But that's really just not any of us.
Right, right. It's not a realistic strategy, at least at this point. So another thing that I hear now, really more with the COVID vaccine, because it has, mRNA or DNA technology, if you're talking about, the three main ones, which would be the Moderna, the Pfizer, and the J&J, this fear of genetic manipulation, it's going to change my DNA.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. It would take sort of a mad evil scientist, working very hard to change someone's DNA. Basically anytime you eat anything, a plant, an animal, or a fish, it's got DNA in it. Everything that's alive, has DNA in it. Every time you get a little cut, probably 1,000 little, billion little bacteria, make it into your bloodstream. So your body's sort of used to, used to DNA and used to RNA getting into it. It doesn't change your genetic code. And at this point, how many million Americans have been vaccinated? And probably, over half the country, 160 million. We're all doing okay so far. I don't think my DNA has changed very much. So I don't feel any different. That's
36% of the entire world, which is low in the sense that if we want to fight COVID, we have to actually vaccinate a lot more of the world. But it's just a striking idea that we spoke a year ago in August and there was no vaccine. And now there's a vaccine and 36% of the entire world is vaccinated.
Yeah, I think, and I almost get a little teary-eyed when I talk about this, but I think it's the greatest scientific achievement of my lifetime. that you're right, that a year ago there was no vaccine, and now we have multiple effective vaccines. And, you know, what I find amazing and awe-inspiring, and we can talk a little bit about this, I think worries people because they feel the vaccine was rushed.
Right. People say that too, right.
That's not true. And I can give several reasons why that's not the case. So there are two things here. Vaccine development went quickly, okay? But that doesn't mean that things were rushed. And there's a number of reasons why. So number one, scientists weren't starting from scratch. They had been working with prior coronaviruses. This is not the first coronavirus to affect humanity. It's the first one to spread widely. But they got a head start with some other coronaviruses, number one. They've been using mRNA technology for many years. So, mm-hmm. You know, they weren't just starting from scratch, you know, January 2020. That's number one. Number two, money was no object. You know, the government and the pharmaceutical companies threw every dollar they had beside, you know, behind developing vaccines, which is unusual because vaccines are not big money makers. And there's, you know, never in our lifetimes has there been this sort of pressure to develop a vaccine. Number three, people were beating down the door to be in the trials. Normally, it's very hard to recruit people to be in medical experiments, but this was the opposite. You know, they were knocking at the door saying, let me in the study. And I was one of those people. I volunteered to be in the study.
Oh,
and
wow.
I'm extremely proud of that, actually. And I everyone who volunteered to be in the study should be. So that's reason number three, I think. Reason number four is the way that the trials worked were as follows. So they gave 20,000 people the vaccine. 20,000 people, the fake vaccine or placebo, and they said, okay, we're going to wait until 200 people in our study get COVID, and then we're going to look at the results. And unfortunately, COVID spread very quickly, so they didn't have to wait very long. Before you know it, they had 200 cases of COVID, and something like 190 of them were in the people who got the placebo, the fake vaccine, and 10 were in people who got the real vaccine. So the trials just went very quickly for all those reasons, but no safety steps were skipped. And now that the vaccines have been out in the real world and hundreds of millions of people have taken them, they are continually monitored for safety. And indeed, some side effects have emerged. And while I'm not happy that that's the case, I think it should give everyone confidence that two things. Number one, that people take vaccine safety very seriously, that these side effects aren't brushed under the rug, and that nothing is hidden. So the fact that a 1 in 50,000 serious vaccine side effect, or even less than that, was detected and publicized, I think should make everyone pretty confident and secure that the vaccines are not perfectly safe. Nothing's perfectly safe, but extremely safe.
That's absolutely true. And I'm going to just put another plug for a talk I did with Dr. Gregory Poland of the Mayo Clinic. It's called Nothing is Risk-Free. And again, we go into much more detail on how to make a risk-benefit decision-making, comparing the risks of the vaccine, which exists, to the risks of the disease. I want to just say one article that I pulled recently. It just came out a few weeks ago, August 25th, in the New England Journal of Medicine. And it's a report from Israel. Noam Barda is the first author, and it's safety of the Pfizer, well, it's the BNT1, whatever, the Pfizer vaccine in a nationwide setting. And what they did is they compared the side effects of the vaccine to COVID. And I think that that's a really informative article. It was on how many people I think it's the Maccabee Health Center. So it's a huge, huge population. Almost 1 million people, 884,828, in both the vaccinated and the control group. That's a lot of people. And
yeah,
so they really were able to see tremendous difference.
These studies were enormous.
Yes, because that's a big thing people are saying is I'm hearing somebody who got damaged by the vaccine.
Correct.
Right? We heard that from any vaccine. And we called this back in August. We said, we're going to hear tons of people complaining that the vaccine did something to them or their loved ones.
Right. So two things about that. Number one is, as we said, 160 million Americans have gotten this vaccine. So something bad is going to happen to some of those people. If I gave 160 million Americans a glass of water, you know, especially considering the people who got vaccinated first tend to be older and frailer people. But if I gave 160 million Americans a glass of water and waited a month, some of them would be dead. Some of them would, you know, be in a car crash, anything. I met people who had horrible things happen right before they were supposed to get vaccinated for COVID. So, and I met people who had good things happen after they got COVID, who, you know, they got a promotion, they got married, after they got the COVID vaccine. You know, someone I know right. became pregnant. So, you know, good things have happened to people after they got the COVID vaccine too. But there are side effects. There are some very rare, serious side effects, and we shouldn't pretend, I don't think anyone is, that they don't exist. But any
right,
side
and,
effect.
And I want to get to them.
Sure. Any side effect that you name with the vaccine occurs more often and more serious with the virus. Give me any side effect and the virus causes it more.
Right. The only thing that I would say would be different would be an anaphylactic reaction, like an allergic reaction. I don't think you'd
That is true. I stand corrected. That's a good point.
Right.
You want to talk about that? Right. Describe what that is? That's kind of a fancy word.
Right. So the anaphylactic or severe allergic reaction to this vaccine is occurring a little bit more commonly than, say, for the flu vaccine, which I believe is 1 in 1 million. It's super rare. I think at this point they're saying 5 or 6 in 1 million. But
yeah,
see, it happens to my neighbor. And see, when something happens to somebody you know, you perceive it as more common.
Oh, yeah. Right? Absolutely. Absolutely.
And she was fine. And she was fine. I think that everybody who had an allergic reaction was fine. This is something that we were aware of, that the polyethylene glycol, or the lipid fatty coating that's used to coat the mRNA so it doesn't disintegrate immediately, is the same ingredient in Miralax. In fact, that's what this person had. They did not know they were allergic to that ingredient, that Miralax. And they were fine. And I think in this particular family, it was easy to put it in context because another family member was hospitalized for COVID.
Yeah. So it's true that definitely something that happens to a neighbor or friend of ours is just going to be more powerful to us right. than something we, you know, read about in a newspaper. And one thing that these vaccine side effects have is the clinical trials that I described. They were published in the most prestigious medical journals, the New England Journal of Medicine. But they're boring. I mean, they're full of sort of statistics and you know, methods and results and doctor words, and they're not fun reading. They're not interesting. No one is going to read this paper and feel sad for the people in the study who got COVID. They're just baseless numbers, you know. But if your neighbor takes the vaccine and, you know, 2 weeks later is diagnosed with cancer, oh my God, that's your neighbor, and that's a horrible thing. And you know this person, you care about this person, you see them suffering. So the data supporting the safety of the vaccines doesn't hit us at an emotional level. And that's how we make decisions a lot of the time, you know, often with not very good consequences, unfortunately.
Right. And, you know, we mentioned the more serious side effects of the vaccine, because most of the effects of the vaccine are not serious. You have a sore arm, you have some fever or chills, or, you know, there have been some swollen lymph nodes. There are a number of side effects that are not particularly serious, but there have been some that have been identified, and they've all been discussed openly. One of those is the myocarditis, and that was what they went into detail in this New England Journal of Medicine article. They compared the risk of myocarditis from the vaccine to the risk of myocarditis from COVID. And that was something that we've been looking for, because you want to compare it, right? I mean, am I going to have a higher risk of myocarditis from the vaccine or the virus? That's
exactly
a fair
right.
question. And the answer was it was multiple times higher risk from the illness in this extremely large study.
Yeah. No, that's you know, that's exactly right. I mean, so myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart, mm-hmm. heart muscle, you know, sounds bad. And it can be. It can be a fatal condition, but sort of like many things in medicine, it exists on a spectrum. You know, you can have a mild paper cut or a severe, you know, fatal cut. So myocarditis is a little bit like that. It just exists on the spectrum. And it most commonly occurs in young men, or boys even, between the ages of 12 and 24, okay? And there's a few things to consider when talking about this condition. Number one, how often it happens. And then number two is how severe it is, okay? So I've looked at pretty much all the studies and all the data on about how common it is. And I'll be honest with you, I don't have a really good sense of that. It's not common. It's not common, but the exact rate, I can't quote to you exactly. You know, it can be hard to monitor vaccine side effects. The government has several vaccine safety databases available, and different countries have different safety databases. So here in America, the CDC estimated that this occurs in about 1 in 14,000 boys. Okay. In Canada, they found a little bit of a higher rate, 1 in 11,000 boys, and maybe even a little bit higher, 1 in about 7,000 men age 18 to 24. Israel initially reported a rate of about 1 in 3,000 or 1 in 6,000. They haven't repeated that rate. And a big study just came out from California. I think they looked at 6.2 million people who've gotten vaccinated. And the rate there for people under the age of 40 was really low, about 1 in 80,000. So the numbers are a little bit all over the place. So I'm not super confident in describing exactly how often it happens, other than to say not a lot. So that's number one. And the second is how severe it is. And this I feel much more comfortable talking about. So I don't want to minimize it, because everyone with vaccine myocarditis, you know, they feel sick. They can have chest pain. They can have shortness of breath. Almost all the young people go to the hospital with it, and they spend a couple days there. But that's it. Almost all of them leave feeling just fine. None of them have needed life support. They've not needed, you know, a ventilator, for example, and no one has died. So we will have to keep tracks on this over the long term. I don't want to dismiss it. But compared to what the virus has done to children and young adults over that time, it really is, the seatbelt analogy is really perfect. You know, the kids who have vaccine myocarditis are the people, the equivalent of people who've been injured by a seatbelt. It's not cool, it's not fun, but it's generally much better than the alternative.
Do we know what causes the myocarditis? Because, I'm just going to admit that it just sounds scary.
It's probably just an overreaction of the immune system. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this can happen with the virus, right? So like I said at the beginning, anything that the vaccine can do, the virus can do, and it does it more often, and it does it more severe. So children who've had myocarditis due to the virus, it also isn't common. I've heard, you know, one study found a rate of about 1 in 800, which is actually much higher than with the vaccine. But children can sometimes get this condition called MISC, this multisystem inflammatory disorder. Mm-hmm. And that also is pretty rare, probably a little bit like 1 in 3 to 1 in 4,000 children. But the myocarditis caused by that can be devastating. I mean, those kids can go into heart failure. They can need to be ventilated. They can die. So if you're worried about myocarditis, and you should be, you're probably going to be, you know, children are probably going to be fine no matter what, but the odds are in your favor if you get the vaccine, and if your child 12 or older gets the vaccine.
Right. So it's just difficult though, because when you're talking about children, I think it's the hardest conversation is talking about younger people, because that is where the risk of myocarditis, even though it's very, very low from the vaccine, is still in the higher end.
Right. Correct? I think one thing, you know, people have different attitudes towards the virus than they do the vaccine. So if a child has a reaction, or anyone has a reaction to the vaccine, we feel horrible, we feel guilty, we feel we did this to a child, that we took a healthy child, we gave them a medicine, and they got sick. And actually, that's true, right? That is what happens. But when a virus does that, or a virus does work, you know, worse rather, you know, we feel sad, you know, seeing young people suffer is horrible, but we don't feel guilty. We don't feel responsible. We don't feel active. We just feel this was bad luck, which is also true. But people tend to avoid harms that they feel that they caused or that are responsible for more than they do just sort of random bad luck. But, you know, not vaccinating is a choice. It is an active choice. So I view the harms as sort of equivalent, in you know, that when a child gets injured by the virus, it's not somehow different or not as bad as a child who's been injured by a vaccine. But that's not how, you know, our natural instinct isn't to react that way.
Right. It's illogical, though, because if you think about it, what we should be able to do, and I discussed in great length with Dr. Poland in the Nothing Is Risk-Free, is compare the risks of the virus to the risks of the disease.
Yeah,
and just exactly do it. Right. Say which is more likely.
Exactly right. And I can talk about this all day because I've read and written quite a bit about this. So, you know, what are the risks of the virus with children? Well, it depends on how you look at it. Most children, the vast majority of children, thank God, do fine. They do just fine. But so many children are getting sick with this virus. Last week in the United States, 250,000 children got the virus.
Right.
And so a rare harm starts to add up. So most people don't know this. Over 500 children have died in America from this virus. And 100 of these deaths have occurred since July.
Wow. So
2 to 3 children per day that are dying. That doesn't happen with the vaccine. Right now, over 350 kids are going to the hospital every single day in the United States because of COVID. And tens of thousands of children have been hospitalized. And about a third of them, 25 to 33%, wind up in the ICU. And up to 10% of those end up needing to be intubated. So that's not a trivial thing.
You know, I want to say something though, because the problem is I feel like we have two different media presentations or two different approaches. One is children do fine. Like you said, most children do fine. And the other one is talking about the ICU beds that are full, all these terrible stories of children doing, you know, being very, very sick with COVID. And I think it's important to explain what we know about the severity of Delta. We're seeing and we're hearing much more children. The numbers are higher. Does that mean that we're seeing a more severe form of COVID for children?
No, I don't think so. You know, Delta does not, again, thank goodness, does not seem to be more severe for children. It's just more children are getting sick.
Right, right.
You know, so if there was a jar of candy and, you know, one out of every 50,000 pieces of candy was poisoned, you know, if my kid ate from that candy jar, I wouldn't worry too much. I wouldn't want them to. But, you know, if I found out they took a piece of candy from there, you know, I wouldn't lose a ton of sleep. But give that jar of candy to every child in America, you know, one out of 50,000 children die, you know, you're at, that's several thousand dead children. And you know, that's horrible.
That's right. But that's what I think, what we understand from the best of my understanding is they've looked into this, the CDC has looked into this, and they've shown that it's not that the rates of hospitalization per case are higher, it's that the volume, it's just sheer volume.
Exactly,
but
right.
Either way, it's so many children who are suffering, and the ICUs are literally filling up in the areas where it's really spiking, like
right.
In the South.
Even you know, the vast majority of children won't need to go to the hospital, but some of those kids are really sick for weeks, and it's just miserable. And you know, we have to be humble. There are certain viruses that can cause problems years down the road. I don't think this virus is going to do that, but I can't prove it. You got to wait years to find out. And we just have to be, you know, humble. You know, people always ask, what are the long-term side effects
right.
of the vaccine? Well, what are the long-term side effects of the virus? If you're worried about one but not the other, I would sort of really question whether you're thinking about things in a sort of reasonable, accurate way.
Right. It's very unclear how many children get long COVID. I've seen wildly discrepant numbers.
Exactly right. I have two. And it also depends on sort of which way you frame it. So one study I saw sort of bragged, you know, that only 2% of children get long COVID. And by that, they said symptoms lasting 8 weeks or longer. Okay, so that doesn't sound too bad, you know, only 2% of kids. But, you know, something like 4 million children have had COVID.
Right.
And 2% of that, hopefully I'm doing my math here right, is about 50,000 children. So if I said to you, you know, 50,000 children, you know, are sick for 8 weeks, well, holy smokes, that sounds like a pretty bad number.
I mean, we're required as pediatricians to check every child after COVID to clear them for sports because we're worried about long-term cardiac and pulmonary effects. It's not unheard of.
Yeah.
Whatever the exact number is. It's not a benign disease at any age.
No, I mean, this is definitely on par with other diseases that we vaccinate against, the flu, measles, polio even. Polio only affected about 1% of children who contracted it. So, chickenpox. So all of these diseases, the vast majority of children were fine, but because so many children got them, it added up to what I think are significant numbers of sick and dead children. And teenagers have died this summer who are old enough to be vaccinated. So these deaths are now completely preventable. And you read what some of the parents are saying, and they said things like, I had no idea kids could get this sick. And they said things like, I was very confused about the vaccine. You heard the good, you heard the bad, but no mother should have to go through what I'm going through.
Right. And especially because of all the fertility fears. You know, we talked about genetic manipulation, but we didn't mention fertility. And, you know, when we spoke back in August, we talked about how people were going to say there's long-term effects. They're going to complain that the vaccine, you know, damaged them. I don't think we mentioned fertility, but that is also a frequent thing that's fear-mongered from the anti-vaccine world.
Yeah, every vaccine has been, you know, blamed for fertility issues. It's just something that is very, especially for women, you know, deep in the human psyche is worried about, are you going to be able to have children one day? So this was very predictable. But right now, there are a lot of pregnant women who have had horrible outcomes with COVID.
Right.
And a lot of pregnant women who've had great outcomes after the vaccine.
Right. I actually just did a talk on that last week. That's called More Pandemic Pregnancy with Dr. Denise Moses.
Oh, great.
Yeah. It's a separate, very important topic. But the fear of fertility, I think, drives parents. That's another thing driving parents away from choosing the vaccine for their teenagers.
And when you understand how these vaccines work, it sort of doesn't make sense, right? It's kind of like if I, you know, got out of bed this morning and twisted my ankle, you know, and then 2 weeks from tomorrow, you know, had a heart attack or something like that. You know, you wouldn't say like, oh boy, you twisted your ankle and that caused your heart attack. But with vaccines, that logic seems to break down. Once a person gets vaccinated, there's a tendency to blame everything bad that happens on the vaccine. It's just human condition or human nature to do that, unfortunately.
Right, and to look for patterns. This happened after that, therefore this caused that. And that's the problem with the VAERS database that, you know, a lot of people are very aware of, the vaccine adverse events reporting system, where anybody can, and you should, if you have something that happens after a vaccine that you think could all be related, you don't have to prove it is, you report it. But then it has to be investigated. But all of those reports in that huge database that are not investigated are being touted as showing how dangerous the vaccine is.
Yeah. VAERS is sort of like, let's see, it's kind of like gossip, basically. You know, if someone says to you, oh, did you hear about so-and-so? You know, it may be true, it may not be true. And so VAERS is not useful. You know, VAERS is very useful for picking up potential worrisome trends in vaccines, but anyone can file a VAERS report. I could right now say, you know, I'm a pediatrician in Hawaii and a patient of mine came in with chest pain and, you know, their heart exploded. And you could go do that right now. Just log on, take 2 seconds. I don't think that happens a lot. I don't think people fake a lot of these reports. Don't get me wrong about that. But they're not 100% reliable. And the CDC has investigated them. And, you know, most of them, I think, turned out to be real. They recently published that they investigated about 754 cases of myocarditis, something like that. And when they wrote the report, this was just last week, all but 18 of them were discharged from the hospital. So, you know, 18 people as of last week were sort of currently hospitalized with vaccine myocarditis. And that's about how many children are getting admitted every hour.
Right.
So you have to try to keep these numbers in perspective. And, you know, dealing with numbers can be hard. I've thrown out a lot of numbers this pandemic or this, you know, in the past 30 minutes.
Right.
Pandemic too. And our brains have trouble sort of wrapping around these numbers of 1 in 800. I said 1 in 15,000, 1 in 80,000. You know, eventually they sort of all blend together. But anything, I sound like a broken record, but boy, anything the vaccine can do, the virus does more often and worse.
Right. But you're bringing up the point that the stories are what really gets to people. And it's a problem, right? Because, you know, if I try to tell a story, I may be called, you know, someone who's trying to be emotionally manipulative. I had someone say this to me, you are appealing to emotion. You're manipulating me. And yet that's what the people who are trying to scare people away from the vaccines do all the time.
Yeah. And it's much easier to scare people than it is to unscare them.
Right. Right. Pull off it. Yes.
yeah, exactly right. You know, a single story, of a, you know, someone who's had a bad effect after the vaccine, whether it's a legitimate, side effect or not, will just be more persuasive, than this podcast, right? Then
right.
This, you know, they don't know us, they don't know me.
Right.
You know, the story, you know, I'm not telling any sort of boring, you know, any
exciting
story. I could though, right? I mean, I'm not a pediatrician, but I worked in Bellevue's during New York's COVID horrible surge a year ago. You know, and I can tell you stories about young patients who I saw die. The youngest person I saw die was 23, and he was previously healthy. And, you know, I can tell you that story. I might start tearing up. I still remember, him. I never knew him. You know, I only sort of saw him the last few days of his life, and he was too delirious to talk. And, you know, I always feel horrible. You know, I tortured him a little bit, sticking an IV in him. You know, I'm not too good at that anymore, but we were so short-staffed. And, you know, I never would have done that if I'd known he was going to die. But, of course, we didn't know at that time. And, you know, this is a 23-year-old kid. His life, whole, you know, he had 60, 70 more years on Earth. His whole life was ahead of him and just taken away. So, you know, those of us who are for the vaccine can tell a lot of scary stories, tragic stories about the virus, and they're true. They're true. And, you know, I don't think it's manipulative necessarily to tell those stories as long as they are backed up by science, which they are. So I think someone telling the story of a, you know, 1 in a million vaccine side effect, you know, could be accused of being emotionally manipulative. But that's not necessarily true with the virus.
Right. And you're also bringing up the point that some people say, well, it's not going to be a problem for me because I'm healthy, I'm young, I take vitamins, I eat healthy, I'm not overweight. Although I do have to point out that overweight is a significant risk factor.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is true with this virus. It definitely affects people who are older and thicker more than it affects the young and the healthy. But there's plenty of examples of people who are young and healthy who died of the virus. And, you know, it's interesting. It does seem to be the case, at least more with young adults, that they are getting sicker with the Delta variant. I cannot point to science behind that. I can only sort of point to news stories, you know, that hospitals in Miami are filled with 20 and 30 year olds, whereas during the first few waves, that was not the case.
It still may be a matter of just pure numbers.
Yeah, it might be. You're absolutely right. So that's why I'm very careful to say, you know, I don't have a scientific publication to back this up. It might just be that, you know, thousands more 20 and 30 year olds are getting sick now than they did a year ago.
Right. And there's some really, you know, horrible stories of people who trusted in, you know, vitamins or supplements or ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, instead of the vaccine. And also, by the way, monoclonal antibodies. I want to put a plug in for monoclonal antibodies, because that's another very helpful tool that we have, has to be given early in the disease.
Yeah, it's very strange to me, people who try these things like vitamins and hydroxychloroquine and vermectin, you know, because some people will sort of say, you know, I don't want to put something, you know, in my body or this sort of thing. And yet I look at what they're taking, and they're taking 20 supplements, and they're like, holy smokes, you know, listen, I'm just asking you to get a shot twice. And, you know, meanwhile, you're taking 20 pills every day. And these pills haven't been tested. So it's very, it's interesting to me how some people, I think there's a whole group of people out there who, let's say Joe Biden banned the vaccine and said, you know, the vaccine is now illegal. You can't get it. These people would demand it. They would then say, oh, wait, hey, you know, now you're telling me I can't get the vaccine. Now I want it. So human nature is kind of
right. I mean, to be fair, we've had a, you know, disaster of a, you know, public health communication. And so it's not surprising that people aren't trusting and they're looking for something to trust. I think what's happening is people don't trust the mainstream media. They don't trust the mainstream, you know, politicians or physicians or, you know, all of these, you know, the face of the pandemic. And so they get people that they do trust because they know I can't know everything. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an epidemiologist. And then these people who often are doctors with some great credentials come out and tell them, no, the vaccine's dangerous. Take ivermectin. What are they supposed to think?
Yeah, no, it can be very difficult, this pandemic. And if you can find some doctor out there telling you 1 + 1 = 3, you know, just know that in medicine and probably most science, it's extremely, extremely rare that there is one or two doctors who have figured out something that no other doctor, you know, figured out, that the tens of thousands of other doctors, you know, have somehow missed. These doctors, in my experience, rarely work with COVID patients, right? When I was working in, you know, Bellevue COVID wards on the, you know, weekends and this sort of thing, these doctors were not there. You know, they were posting online about how brilliant they were and how much better they would be doing if they actually treated sick people, for the most part. And they, you know, they don't publish it in scientific journals, which is a very important thing as well.
But you know what, though? I'm going to disagree with you. Please,
sure.
Forgive me. Since COVID, I mean, I think it was happening before, but certainly since COVID, we are seeing such a blurring of the line between, you know, good science and bad science, between, you know, real science and pseudoscience. It's not clear at all. There are people who publish, and they may be publishing in what's called predatory journals or pay-to-play journals. You know, you don't know if you're not an expert, you know, looking at that journal, that that's not a respected journal, that somebody could print anything they want to in if they pay enough money. Right?
Yeah,
so
no,
it's confusing.
Those journals often have very respectable sounding names. I could just make one up right now. You know, the Journal of the American, you know, Infectious Society, right? I mean, it sounds
very... How would you know? Right.
I just made that up. You know, and they look sort of very fancy, right? But you know, I sort of get these emails from time to time from them, you know, would you like to publish in our journal, you know, $100 and we'll print anything. You know, it's a problem. It's, you know, another, and the lack of trust doesn't come from nowhere. There have been some real unfortunate cases of scientific fraud this pandemic, where people have just faked numbers. And it's criminal. Those people should get in a lot of trouble. And that's actually happened with a lot of the ivermectin studies, is that when people looked at the data, the numbers just didn't make sense. They were like too good to be true.
Right. And if people want to look into that more, they can go on that same blog that you go on, the Science-Based Medicine and Respectful Insolence, both are which headed by Dr. David Gorski, who I also got to interview. And he's, I think, up to part 6 of ivermectin. It just came out.
Yeah, no, he writes very long essays. So,
yeah,
you know,
very detailed.
Reserve half an hour for each one. But yeah, he goes really into detail, right? About how, you know, that this stuff is fraudulent, and it's horrible.
We're not even mentioning Big Pharma. So before COVID, there was still a fear of Big Pharma, which we talked about in our first talks. So we don't have to go, you know, in depth about Big Pharma, and you know, there are real issues, and it's understandable, just like it's understandable that people would trust less with the communication fiascos we had. But it's not even like it's so few physicians anymore. I mean, I know there's this concept of the magnified minority. They make themselves, like if you look at the people for ivermectin, they have mm-hmm. this whole frontline care and, you know, all of these large organizations full of physicians behind it. To me, it's so understandable that somebody would follow them and think that they were legit.
Yeah. Just a word about Big Pharma. You know, Big Pharma is good and bad, right? I think they did right. an amazing job of developing these vaccines. And, you know, we can, you know, tell horror stories about OxyContin and Purdue Pharmaceuticals and, you know, this sort of thing. But people who are in the hospital with COVID, the first hour they're in the hospital, receive more drugs and more expensive medications than 1,000 vaccinated people. So if your goal, and I suppose I do have this goal, you know, is to sort of prevent people from using drugs and enriching Big Pharma, this 2-shot vaccine, and, you know, we may need a booster, so maybe 3 shots, who knows, it's a new virus we're learning, but is infinitely cheaper than someone who spends 2 weeks in the hospital, sedated, on, you know, with sedatives, you know, getting antibiotics and, you know, medicines to bring down their fever. If you want to avoid medications, as you should, the vaccine is your best bet.
Right. You know, I'm thinking of Joe Rogan. You know, Joe Rogan recently said, you know, he had COVID and he did great and he was taking ivermectin and he also had monoclonal antibodies.
Yeah.
And who knows what else?
Yeah. Does everyone know who Joe Rogan is? You want to describe what happened there a little bit?
Oh, Joe Rogan. I just know that he's, let's say, more conservative and more talking out against the vaccine and for ivermectin.
Yeah. So, I mean,
I actually ignore stuff like that.
No, I mean, so he's a podcaster. I don't listen. He's a former wrestler or something like that, you know, but he has a massive following and he contracted COVID, you know, and he just threw the kitchen sink at himself. And you know, his odds were pretty good with COVID anyway. You know, he's not that old. It's probably 40s or something like that, in pretty good shape. So the odds were in his favor. And, you know, he got better, and it was really only the ivermectin that he gave credit to, unfortunately.
Right. But that's not true.
Ivermectin was really just a sort of a drug pulled at random. And it's interesting, you know, a year ago, this drug pulled at random was hydroxychloroquine.
Right.
And that's, you know, people just seamlessly moved from one to the other, you know, as a miracle cure. But miracle cures are extremely rare in medicine, unfortunately. And especially the idea that you would just pick a drug off the shelf that is used for a totally different reason, and it would work for this brand new virus. You know, it's like turning to a random page of a book and expecting to get directions, you know, to a friend's house or something like that.
But I think that with ivermectin, it showed efficacy at very high doses in a petri dish, which was not what we could do in human beings. But I think that they were looking for inexpensive drugs that could be repurposed, which sounds good. I mean, we're all throwing everything at COVID we could in the beginning to see what sticks. The question I have is, why are we still harping on this drug?
Because it became the fad suppressed miracle cure, and you know, people are desperate for a way to cure COVID or to stay safe, and everyone loves a lot of people love the attraction of sort of secret knowledge and suppressed knowledge. This is what they don't want you to know about. You know, but I didn't go to medical school for 4 years and, you know, go do another residency for, you know, 6 years and work overnight shifts and weekends, to hide things from people. You know, it wasn't like, okay, phew, I'm finally done. Now I can hide the cure from people. You know, that's not how doctors work. That's not what we do.
Right. But if you think about motivation of the doctors who were doing this, 'cause I think about that, what is their motivation?
So I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, you talked about these frontline doctors. I mean, if at the most unethical, I think that they were selling the drug. I think that they were having websites where they could, you know, get money. I think if you want to sort of give people the benefit of the doubt, there's a thrill of sorts of sort of thinking, you know, I'm special. I know more than every other doctor. And, you know, I discovered this sort of great cure that all my, you know, stupid colleagues don't know about. And it allowed them to sort of feel special, different, and superior to the rest of us.
And not just that, but I'm going to quote my friend Ed Nierenberg of Deplatformed Disease, who's phenomenal. He says, chaos is a ladder, right? I mean, this is a chance for someone to be a hero.
Yeah, yeah.
And get fame. So I think that there's, you know, a lot of potential motivations, but from, you know, the general person who's trying to figure out what to do, I think that you have to be very, very careful and go to reliable resources.
Yeah, you know, I mean, again, if you type ivermectin cures COVID into Google right now, I mean, you'll find probably, you know, 20 pages that support exactly what you want to believe. But we talk about something, the scientific consensus, right? And what exactly does this mean? This just means that most doctors and most scientists, you know, often coming from different fields. So, you know, one doctor can be a pulmonologist, an expert in the lungs, and another can be an expert in viruses, you know, believe the same thing. And it's not always right. It's not always right. The scientific consensus can be wrong. But for the most part, it isn't, right? I mean, if your faucet broke and you got 10 plumbers in and said, you know, here's the part that you need, and an 11th plumber came around and said, no, they're all wrong, here's the part that you need, you know, probably that the first 10 would be right. And science generally works that way as well. And if you're the 11th plumber saying the other 10 plumbers are wrong, you better have really solid evidence, really good evidence. Like that 11th plumber, the burden of proof is on him to say that the first 10 plumbers don't know what they're talking about.
Right. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Was that Carl Sagan?
That's Carl Sagan, I think. You got it right. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, right?
So from your book.
No, it's from many books. But, you know, so right. So if a doctor shows that believes that ivermectin cures COVID, you know, that doctor should have evidence like we do for the vaccines from these massive randomized placebo-controlled trials showing a huge effect that were carried out by reputable scientists at major research universities, you know, not some, you know, doctor who gave 10 people ivermectin in his clinic and they all did fine. You know, that really proved nothing.
But you know, the problem is that the news wants things that are, you know, people want to read, something interesting, something happening. I mean, it's not like if they said, okay, all these people all over the world got the vaccine and some of them got sore arms, that wouldn't be news.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly. Right.
It's not bleeding and leading. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. So, you know, people want to hear things and they're more drawn to things that are more dramatic. And it's not so dramatic if you have a very nuanced, you know, piece saying, well, the vaccines work. They work well most of the time, right? But it's much more interesting to hear, right? Oh, there's high breakthrough rate in Israel and all these people are getting sick. Right, so part of the problem, I think, is unfortunately the media, and I think part of the problem is just that we're living in an infodemic. I think I said in one of our talks we should flatten the infodemic curve. Wish we could.
Yeah, no, we're in it. I mean, I think what people are learning too is that this is how sort of science works. This is a new virus, a new vaccine. So we are learning on the fly. Every other vaccine that we talked about, with maybe the exception of HPV, has been around for like 50 years. So when we talk about the measles vaccine or the polio vaccine, you know, there's not going to be any surprises there. We're not going to learn anything new about that. And these diseases have been with us, you know, since antiquity for thousands of years. So this is a new virus, a new vaccine. We're learning as we go. And the recommendations may change, and that's how science works.
Right. Michael Osterholm has quoted somebody else calling it corrected science. You know, we think, oh, you know, eggs are good, eggs are bad, and, you know, this is good, this is bad. They never know anything. And that's not true, especially for this. We're learning as we go along. We're all learning together. But I think something else that has to be, you know, pointed out is that the virus isn't standing still while we figure it out.
Right, right, exactly right. You know, and I think that if this virus moved more slowly, like HIV, you know, there would be time to sort of really figure out, you know, exactly what is the best vaccine, how many doses, how far apart, you know, we could do that. And I think we will do that for this as well. But with 250,000 kids getting sick every week, and that's just the ones we know of, by the way, it's right. Probably double or triple that, you know, who weren't tested, but got sick. You know, the virus is just, it's just not giving us time. We don't have the time to do all of the studies that we want to do to figure things out exactly how we, you know, what's best, unfortunately.
Right. But we're at the point, though, that I think that we have to learn. I hate the phrase learning to live with COVID at the same time I'm using it, because it's been used to be dismissive, you know, to minimize the risks that we're facing right now. We certainly don't have a handle on this. But we can't stay in lockdown.
No, but I don't think anyone's suggesting that. I don't think anyone is suggesting, you know, closing. So it's kind of a, you know, when people say that, you know, no one's really suggesting that. You know, the best thing to do, sound like a broken record, but is to vaccinate yourself. Make sure that everyone you come into contact with is vaccinated. You know, we talked a little, you know, you mentioned breakthrough infections and, you know, people may sort of say, like, oh, what's it matter? They got sick anyway. But, you know, breakthrough infections are real. Again, I'm not going to deny that, you know, but they tend to be much milder. So it converts, you know, someone who gets COVID after they're vaccinated, you know, feels sick for a week, which stinks, you know, you don't want to minimize that. But that same person could have been, you know, hospitalized or dead if they had not gotten the vaccine. So.
Right. You're saying that, except that I keep hearing people talk about the Israel data, and the Israel data has been, you know, put out in such a way, oh, there are more vaccinated people really sick with COVID. See, the vaccines don't work.
Yeah, so that's true, but there's something you have to take into account. Are you really comparing equal groups?
Right.
So here's a true fact. Are you ready? 2/3 of people who get in fatal car crashes, they die in a car crash, they are sober when they drive.
Right.
Okay. Do you think it is safer to drive drunk or to drive sober? Well, obviously we know that, you know, 99.99% of the people who are driving, we hope, this is probably true, are sober. And it's just the, you know, very small percentage of people who drive drunk, but they are much more likely to get in a car crash. And the same is true with the vaccine. So I don't know the exact numbers in Israel off the top of my head, but the vast majority of people, especially older people, are vaccinated there. And so it makes more sense that if, you know, if 90% of people are vaccinated, you're not comparing equal groups. It's not 50-50 anymore. I mean, by the same logic, this is another true stat, 90% of people who get cancer are right-handed. Well, that's going to be true of anything. 90% of people who win the lottery are right-handed. 90% of people who, you know, write beautiful music are right-handed. So actually, I don't know about that one, but you get my point.
Yeah, they might be more left-handed, but anyway.
90% of people, you know, just about anything, get struck by lightning are right. This is because there's a lot more right-handed people in the world. That's probably true of people who are hospitalized with COVID. 90% of them are right-handed. So when you think of, when you hear these statistics, you really sort of have to dig down and ask yourself, are they really comparing equal groups?
Right. You'll say, what's the denominator? Right. What's on the bottom of there? Out of how many?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So that, you know, so if, you know, 10 vaccinated people get COVID and 10 unvaccinated people get COVID, that might be, you know, you might think, hey, that's equal, but it might be 10, you know, out of 100,000 unvaccinated people, you know, vaccinated people, right. And it might be 10 out of 20 unvaccinated people. So you're much better off being in the vaccinated group.
Right. So when you look at this data, you should be sure that it's per 100,000 population. That will give you a denominator, and that will frame it in a way that will give you a fair assessment. And when you look at it that way, by far the unvaccinated are hospitalized, are sicker, right? Yeah. Are doing more poorly or dying, you know, even in Israel.
Okay. Yeah, no, I've thought more about numerators and denominators this pandemic than I have in, you know, since I was in middle school. You know, I've just been thinking about these things all the time.
You know, I realize that we're up for our time, and I want to thank you so much for doing this with me. I just want to mention to everybody who's listening, go to science-based medicine, sciencebasedmedicine.org?
Com, I think.
Com. And look up Dr. Jonathan Howard. He has now has a regular column, a regular blog post there. I think it comes out every Friday, coming out a new one tomorrow. I'm very excited. Yeah. And has been writing really a lot as a pediatrician. My pediatrician heart loves that you do this, has been writing a lot about children in COVID. And I think that's especially important now. Hopefully we will be able to get a vaccine out for younger children, because that's a big problem. And in the meantime, people who are eligible for getting vaccinated should do so. That's one way to protect our children. That can't be it.
Yep, absolutely.
So thank you so much for doing this with me.
Hey, thank you for having me. I always love talking to you. It's so fun.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's J-O-W-M-A.org, or email us at health@joma.org.